So anyway, this mission thing is just a good example of the functional part again. Let's see, I don't want to hang up on these charts too long. Of course, all this required a great deal of travel, and it was about that time that some headquarters recognized, and we all recognized, the need for communicating, not just by writing and not just by telephone, but by having our conferences together. So that's when the idea of this control center network sprang up. We have diagrams over here. This is the way it is today. It wasn't this extensive when it first got started. By the way, all NASA communications are contracted for and managed by the Marshall Center. Looks quite strange. Well, we have a Saturn probe control center. let's see, and that's the headquarters. We had an Apollo. This changed.
Yeah.
We had an Apollo center. In fact, we wanted two of them because at that time they had two different buildings. The federal building 10 had one, and there was one of the Farm Plaza. Maybe it was a pretty good one. A lot of people. At the Cape, we have an Apollo Action Center. And at Houston, and Apollo Action Center. These were tied in by a so-called four-wire network. And all that meant was we had a leased wire that could both transmit and receive voice simultaneously, unlike many voice-activated circuits. Again, this seems to be something of a minor detail, but it actually has some importance. And you have written this up very nicely, too, by the way. And I'll just repeat it, though. And that is that people could sit in this conference room, in the conference room at the Cape, at the headquarters, the man could make his presentation, and people anywhere in the room, by virtue of these overhead microphones, which were tuned so as not to have feedback, anybody anywhere in the room could speak equally well to any other control room. And this greatly facilitated communications in a free form type of conference. Enabled, see, what you usually had was your managers sitting around this main table here. Your project managers, your functional managers, a typical conference, let's say. And then around the room, they would have invited guys that whatever the problem was, let's say S2 structures, they would have guys from the R&D lab, the contractor, local representatives, systems engineering perhaps, and whoever happened to be involved, maybe the quality people. They always, they'd be sitting around the room. They were secondary characters in the act. However, they were fully observers, and they didn't have to go up to the table or anything like that to speak. They could speak from their chair. Mm-hmm. And this psychologically made them more likely to speak up. Mm-hmm. In other words, I don't know what you'd call it, managerial-wise. I guess it's, if you've ever heard of Douglas McGregor and Theory X and Theory Y, you know, the autocratic and the democratic participative type of management. Mm-hmm. The idea that you usually found in Saturn V was not autocratic, it was participative. No matter who the engineer was or where he was, they were going to give him a chance to talk. He said, I think the so-and-so valve, when we put this hydrogen in this thing, I think that valve's going to start closing slowly. He said, I know it acts fine at regular temperatures, but if he thought that for any reason that it was going to close a little slowly, a few milliseconds slow, they'd listen to the man. That's the reason that this thing was done like this. There wasn't one firm leader at the front that said, I speak for the Marshall Space Flight Center.
Yeah.
Everybody spoke. Yeah. Said, well, that's a hell of a way to run an organization. Mm-hmm. And what it did was sort of like a weeding machine. What do you call it? The wolf in the wolf.
Oh, yeah. But you didn't, did you get into a situation where too many people were trying to speak at once, or was there just a natural inclination to control? Self-control.
You could get into it, especially if they got a little excited about the subject. At that point, the chairman of the meeting in the control room had to get the thing under control.
Yeah.
That was the trick. He didn't didn't dictate what was said, but he said, okay, fellas, everybody get a chance to talk. Let's, you know, a little Robert Rule of War here. We'll all get a chance.
I'm noticing these signs on the table, teleconference tips, warning you that the mic picks up every word and every sound. Did I remember correctly once you said that you had problems with that because people started making, you know, not snide, but sharp comments about people elsewhere, and they found out that it was picked up? And
that's yeah, right.
Yeah. And it would override the major speaker. If some guy was making a presentation, these things tended to override sometimes.
Yes, because if a man speaks louder in the back of the room than the man in the front is speaking, then he'll become the guy that everybody hears in all these other places. Yeah. Most people think because he sits in the back of the room that there's a microphone in the front of the room. It's a holdover from the 1930s.
Yeah.
Saved a lot of airplane flights, I'll have to say. I thought it was one of the best things anybody ever did, was to have this network of conference rooms set up. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was briefing some people one day, and I happened to have this guy from an airline there. I said, it saves you the trouble of physically removing bodies from one point to another. You can get the thought. And he said, well, wait a minute. But about that time, and the same audience was a man from Bell Telephone. He says, great idea!
Okay, I'm glad you reminded me of this conference center network, because I'd forgotten that, and I don't think I really brought that out as clearly as I should have in the rough draft that I've got.
Yeah, I think that was a very important thing. Because it was a, you know, instantaneous thing, and if you wanted a file on something, you had it, you know, just right down the hall or in the next building over. And a lot of times they'd go dig these things out while the meeting was in progress. Roger, do you think there's any need to go through all these charts? Let me just.
No, I think that the.
I think you see what
we've
got
right
here.
Right idea of what the charts were about, and the fact that you could single thread things down to a small. Small detail.
Right.
And I'm glad you brought out, too, that there were functional charts as well as hardware charts, and I should bring that out in my writing, too.
Here's a rather complicated chart.
The spec tree.
The spec tree. did them. Got to keep that up. Dr. Rudolph had a Christmas party, and he always referred to himself as just a simple blacksmith. Have you ever heard that term?
Maybe you
know. Nobody's ever. Well, anyway, that was his little technique of getting people to come down out of them. It's esoteric technological terms, which were sometimes used simply to cloud the issue. And he bore in until they could explain it in simple terms. And he'd play dumb. You know, he said, well, I'm just a simple blacksmith. You know, here's this guy, a veteran of the V2 program, the Pershing program manager. I'm a simple blacksmith. So I wrote him a little thing, a parody on Longfellow, Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, the Village Smithy Stands. I wrote a parody on that called Under the Specification Tree, the Saturn Smithy Stands. And went on and on about that. And he thought that was a great, he got a kick out of that. Anyway, I see the specification, Under the Spreading Specification Tree.
Yeah, sure is.
There you go. And this did tie in all the specs very well. And the specification, of course, is what does a piece of hardware have to do? If you don't know what it has to do, then it almost becomes a person's own interpretation. He says, well, I think it ought to do so-and-so. But once you write it down, you have to get somebody's approval, it solidifies.
Yeah, that sounds so obvious, but it strikes me that it's always the obvious things that can hang you up. Because if you give a guy and say, we want a valve that will withstand 500 PSI under certain conditions, he said, okay, I can do that. So he builds a valve that will do it. But that valve may not do the job that it's really required to do in terms of interfacing someplace else. So you've got to do the spec. You have to design the valve to do this and such and interface someplace else. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. You know, at one time, I think I mentioned these charts to you here. At one time, the program manager says, we have so many documents in this thing. I don't know. He says, I don't think everybody understands what takes precedence. You see, if you work in the mission operations area, you tend to take a document called a mission operations plan, which is put out at headquarters and signed off by some fairly high-ranking cat up there, and you say, well, that's the mission operations plan. I'm going to follow that. See, I'm an insider now. I follow what the man puts out. But you may find out that there's a document that supersedes the mission operations plan. It might be the Apollo program development plan, in which case that is the case here. And their configuration management manual. R&QA manuals, test requirements, and all these were very official. The program spec, the Saturn V project spec. And how did all these relate to each other? And I spent weeks and weeks sifting through every document I could find in a whole Saturn program and tried to relate these things and finally divided them into functional groups, you see, like this, Manning and Finance, Technical Description and Systems Engineering, Reliability and Quality Assurance, Test, Mission Ops, Logistics, Procurement and Contracts, Schedules, and showed what document required, what other document, and how this thing flows. Some of these are planning documents, and some are reporting documents. And this is a fairly obvious thing, too. You say, well, heck, everybody knows that. But the funny thing is, all these documents arose without any plan. People saw the need for a document, and they would go ahead and produce this thing, either at the Apollo program level or at the Saturn V project level. And sometimes the center would turn out plans. They'd turn out the regulations for inspecting hook bolts, the specifications for inspecting hook bolts. They'd say, well, that's it. And see, maybe that's a very expensive process, and maybe the project or program manager didn't want to follow that. Well, do you have to follow that? I don't know. So what this was trying to sort out what document took precedence over what other document. Mm-hmm. And it's a very dull-looking two pages here, but every time we explain this to somebody from headquarters or somebody from the Senate or from the Department of Defense, they thought this was a terrific idea because it gave a visible coherence to the documentation.
It strikes me you can never write that thing logically in a narrative. It's like, you know, you could never say this takes precedence over that except in instances where, because that's what you get into. But if you can visualize it like that and see the lines of coordination, you can very readily grasp the scene. Yeah.
I thought it was sort of a dull thing when Bill Sneed first told me to do it. But then as I got into it, I began to see what the problem was. That nobody knew what was really the ruling document and which ones were co-equal and so forth. Oh, here's a chart on incentive contracting. See, we're converting to incentive contracts. You mentioned that. And here we got Ed King. He's a staff member, and he's following us on all the stages. By the way, that didn't come to happen on all the stages. Here's a thing on the liability. All the stages.